Playground State Report with Michael Patrick Leahy and Doug Kellen.
And welcome in to the Battleground State Report here at 6 o'clock on Saturday. Talk Radio 98.3 WLAC here in Nashville. Doug Kellett is off today, and we are delighted to have as our guest co-host today, former Congressman Jim Renacci from Ohio. Welcome, Jim.
Well, good morning, Michael. How are you today?
I'm just delighted to have you on. I want to have you tell a little bit of your story. I want to start with why you decided to run for Congress in 2010. This is a fabulous story, so let's hear the story.
Well, Michael, you know, I was a business guy for almost three decades, created 1,500 jobs, employed over 3,000 people. One of those businesses was a Chevy dealership, and most of your listeners will know back in 2009, General Motors actually went into bankruptcy. They were forced into bankruptcy by the federal government. Of course, I was running a General Motors dealership, a Chevy dealership here in Ohio. It was successful. I was asked by General Motors to run it. We were moving forward with building a brand new location. I invested some money in it. And lo and behold, the federal government took over General Motors, forced them into the bankruptcy, which really was a plan to eliminate dealerships. Now, I never thought my dealership was going to be eliminated. I had a great working relationship and invested a couple million dollars into the business over about 6 years. And I thought life was going pretty well. And my communications with General Motors, it seemed like it was going well. But what happened was, in July of 2009, I got every dealership in the country got a letter that basically told them whether they were going to be part of the General Motors family going forward or not. To my surprise and shock, when I opened up my letter, it said that I would not be part of the General Motors family going forward, which was kind of like a kick in the stomach. I realized that the federal government now had become a part of General Motors and was making this decision. I reached out to my congressman because I heard that U.S. members of Congress could help. This individual had been in office for 2 years. He was well-liked by the president at that time, President Obama. He was also an ally of Nancy Pelosi at the time. But I was hoping he was going to be an ally of me and my 53 employees who were working with me. And he came to visit. He explained that he could help, told me all the things about how much he was going to be able to make sure that my dealership was saved. And remember, there were a lot of dealerships throughout the country that had gotten this letter, but politically, there were some that were being saved by Democrats in Congress. So I was hoping this was going to work for me. But lo and behold, when the vote came through in July to reinstate my dealership and many others, this congressman voted against it. And Michael, that was another kick in the stomach for me.
Yeah, really?
I believed in this guy. And long story short, I called him up and said, not only are you a liar, I left him a message, not only are you a liar, but look, you can't be trusted. I'm going to remove you from office. And when I didn't see anybody else really that could step up and beat him, I did. And a year and a half later, I became the U.S. Congressman.
And you beat him pretty soundly, too, as I recall. He defeated in 2008, was he first elected? And he won by like 10 points in this kind of swing district of Ohio. How much did you beat him by?
Yeah, he won by 10, and I beat him by 11. It was it was almost a 21-point spread. But I got to tell you, Michael, as a businessman getting into politics, it was definitely a different world, kind of like Trump.
Yeah.
Trying to go into a world that's much different.
So you served for four terms in Congress, and then tell us what happened then.
Well, I always said, Michael, after my third term, after 6 years, look, it was a great experience. I had to chuckle. I thought, wow, when I first got there, I am in the same halls as Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin. So many of these, you know, these forefathers that made this country the great country it was. And then I looked around and thought, first I thought, how did I get here? And then I looked around and said, how did they get here? Which was many of my the other members of Congress. And it became an interesting learning experience for about 4 to 6 years. But after that, I realized, how can you really like a place when every week you know you're going to go there and not getting anything done? So in March of 2017, when I was in my fourth term, my seventh year in Congress, I thought, Washington's broken. It can't be fixed. I'm going to go back to the state and try and fix my state. And I jumped into the governor's race in Ohio March 17th, 2018. In January of 2019, the Senate candidate decided he, for family reasons, he couldn't continue. And then I got a call from the White House asking me to get in the Senate race. So I spent almost 2 years in this statewide race, learned a lot about state politics, very similar to federal politics, but got a good handle on what was going on in Ohio. And even though I lost the Senate race to an incumbent who's been around for 45 years and had $35 million in the bank, I gave a good showing. And in the end, I've learned a lot about the state, and I continue to work with the foundation that I formed, which is to try and make Ohio stronger in the future.
Well, Jim Renacci, when you come back, I want to talk about Ohio as a battleground state. How does it look for 2020? Is Trump in the lead? Is it tied? Is it behind? We'll get all that from former Congressman Jim Renacci here on the Battleground State Report. I'm Michael Patrick Leahy. We'll be back after this.
Now back to the Battleground State Report with Michael Patrick Leahy and Doug Kellett.
And welcome back. This is Michael Patrick Leahy, and sitting in for Doug Kellett today, our good friend, former Congressman Jim Renacci from Ohio. Jim, we were talking in the last segment about Ohio, and was going to ask you this question. You know, 2020, a big presidential election up. Ohio, a battleground state. I think President Trump in 2016 won the state ultimately kind of by, what, 9 points was it that he won it by? It was a pretty strong
show. 8 points.
8 points, yeah. So Ohio seems to be a little bit in flux. For a period of time, it was considered one of the top six battleground states. It became not as critical in some polls, but now it seems to be swinging back. And I'm trying to figure out, well, what's going on in Ohio? Why is it suddenly becoming more in play for the presidential election? What's your view on this, Jim?
Well, look, the president did win by 8 points in 2016. But what he did is he was able to bring those Democrat voters who were disenchanted with the Democrat Party. He was, the blue-collar worker from many of the regions of Ohio that just felt that they had not gotten a fair share. And at that time, candidate Trump said, at least give me a chance. And look, he has matched and followed through on every one of his promises. And those voters elected him. They moved from the Democrat Party, voted for him over Hillary. And he was able to, as I say, win by 8 points. Now, since then, Ohio's economy is not growing and not keeping up with the rest of the country. I do think the president is still in the lead and will win in Ohio today. But, Michael, as you know, politics is a 30-day venture. You never know what it's like. I tell people that George Bush Sr., if you remember, was up. I think he had a 90% approval rating at this point in time and then lost by Bill Clinton in November. So we just always have to remember that politics is a 30 to 40 day cycle, and things will change for the better or for the worse between now and November. But the state's not keeping up. I think people are concerned. We lost the General Motors plant in Lordstown, which was a big thing for Ohio, a few thousand jobs. And we're losing several companies here and jobs. We're not going to create as many jobs in 2019. So I think it does give voters a pause. I don't think it's President Trump's fault, though. I think it's just the policies that really are embedded in Ohio politics, not the president's politics, because in the end, thank goodness the president's there and has gotten the economy booming across this country, because it has actually helped Ohio, just not as much as other states.
Why is it that Ohio has really such bad policies for business growth. And it's been that way for a while, I think. But you kind of look at it and you sort of scratch your head. You think Ohio ought to be a lot more business friendly, a lot more entrepreneurial, entrepreneur friendly than it turns out to really be. Why is that?
Well, Ohio is one of the top seven, I think it's the seventh worst tax states in the country. It's one of the top five states for regulations. So businesses have a tough time. Look, I was in business for almost three decades. Businesses have a tough time growing and prospering here. Too many regulations, too many taxes. They've lowered the tax rates here, but you're taxed on everything from property taxes to CAT taxes to sales taxes to state taxes. So we do have a low rate of tax, but we have a high amount of taxes across the board. And I think in the end, the regulations and the taxes are really causing businesses to say, wait a minute, I can go across the border. And here's another interesting thing, Michael. We're the only state that is not right to work that borders us except Pennsylvania. So every state around us is a right to work state. Michigan, Indiana, Kentucky, West Virginia, Pennsylvania is not right to work. So there's also another bonus that some of the reasons why, if you look at General Motors, they've left Lordstown, but they're going to invest in Indiana and invest in Michigan, both right to work states. So I think there's a couple of things that are driving this that the state just hasn't really looked at and said, we got to fix.
In Tennessee, we are a right-to-work state. And in fact, this is new information for you, Jim. This past week, the state Senate passed a law to make it a constitutional amendment of the state constitution that this will always be a right-to-work state. It's got to go through a couple steps before it goes on the ballot, but it's likely to get on the ballot here, and it's likely to be approved in 2021. Tell me, in your view, as a business guy, why it's important to be a right-to-work state?
Well, look, as a right-to-work state, it's freedom of choice. It gives those individuals the opportunity to make the decision whether they want to be in the union, but it also gives businesses the right to say, I want to go to a state that does not have, the union activity that can slow down growth and cause problems. So I think it's just another one of those things businesses look at, and they make their decisions based on that.
What would be the prospects of, if there were an attempt to, in a non-right-to-work state like Ohio, how would anybody go about trying to change that?
Well, one thing that that caused some serious problems for Ohio is Governor Kasich back in 2009, when he first got elected as the governor, he decided to try and go pretty much right to work. And he attacked all segments, police officers, firefighters, all segments, teachers. And I think in the end, he turned so many people away from him and away from the idea that it went down, and it was called SB5. It was really damaging to the state because it just wasn't done right. I've said all along that, this has to be a process where people understand that you can grow, unions can grow and prosper in right-to-work states, but it's really about jobs and business and the economy that has to go first. And I think it's something that has to be educated more. So to do it again because of the failures of Governor Kasich back in 2009, I believe, it's going to have to be an education process to make sure people are aware that it doesn't. We can become a right-to-work state and not hurt unions, actually help business grow and help some union businesses grow as well.
So you talked about former Governor John Kasich. He served in Congress for a while. He was a Fox News contributor, two-term governor. He ran for president for a while, didn't do all that well. I think, if you looked into his soul, his heart, he probably wants to be president someday. What has he been up to of late?
Well, Michael, it's kind of interesting because the biggest problem I find in politics as a businessman is that, number one, most people are always worried about, if you're in politics, you're worried about the next election or the next position. The biggest problem with Governor Kasich is while he was running for governor, he was talking about being president. And I think he was looking at that as a stepping stone. And I say that because all the moves he made while he was in the state as governor were really moves that weren't beneficial for the state of Ohio, but they were really more beneficial for his presidential run. So what happened was he, of course, continued to make moves that moved him much more to the center, sometimes even to left center. Some people said he wasn't a Republican anymore. And, you know, he did not win, of course, as we know. And today he's still out there. He is an anti-Trump Republican. He is a CNN correspondent. And he does bash the president every chance he gets. I think you'll see him step up in 2020 as an anti-Trumper and somebody who will do whatever's necessary to help him lose the election.
Well, we'll talk more about what's going on in not just Ohio, but some of the other battleground states with former Congressman Jim Renacci here. You're listening to the Battleground State Report. I'm Michael Patrick Leahy. We'll be back after this.
This is the Battleground State Report.
And welcome back to the Battleground State Report. I'm Michael Patrick Leahy, and co-hosting today, former Congressman Jim Renacci from Ohio. Jim, we were talking about what's going on in Ohio and how the economy there is not really growing at the same level as around the rest of the country. And your point was that had to do more with the state government policies than the president's policies. Around the country, most other states are doing very, very well. I know you travel on business a lot. I think you spent some time in Florida. You spent some time in Pennsylvania. Let's talk about those two states. You're originally from Pennsylvania. What do you see going on in Florida? What's the tenor of the political conversation there?
Well, look, Florida will be a battleground state again, as we know. They have a governor in Governor DeSantis, who I served with in Congress, somebody who is ready to take on some of the issues that the governor of Ohio and many other states aren't willing to take on. I mean, he has signed executive orders changing whether it's Common Core and many other things. So he is moving Florida forward along with many of the policies that the president has moved forward on, whether it's not taking in refugees, whether it's moving forward on regulations, you know, taxation, all those things. So as when I spend time in Florida, I'm seeing a state that actually will be a battleground state, will always be a tough state, but it's going to lean more and more. Remember, from a pocketbook standpoint, Floridians are having a stronger state and a stronger economy because of the Trump economy, but also because of the governor. Now we switch over to Pennsylvania, and I was just in Pennsylvania last weekend, another pure battleground state. We have a Democrat governor there who continues to push, you know, more regulations. And it's going to be a tougher state. But I actually see President Trump doing reasonably well in Pennsylvania. Remember, he only won by 10,000 votes, I think 10 or 12,000 votes in 2016. People are still happy. I mean, Pittsburgh, for example, was just ranked one of the top 10 technology cities in the country. By the way, versus Cleveland, that was ranked, Cleveland, Ohio, which was ranked one of the bottom 10 states in the country for technology. So they're starting to see that process. When I'm there, those blue-collar Democrats still love the president. I was driving through, and I still see the Trump, you know, 2020 signs, even in some of the areas that steel mills and coal mines are still located in. So I think he's doing better there. Again, he's going to need those battleground states, whether it's Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida. These are the states that are going to be the ones that help him propel and win this next election.
I wonder if you could handicap the Democratic field at the moment. I was up in Iowa last Monday, and witnessed those debacles on the reporting problems of the Iowa caucuses. Depending on who you talk to, Pete Buttigieg won the state delegate equivalence, and Bernie Sanders had a lead in the raw vote in the first alignment of the caucuses. So they both kind of claim victory. Then you go to and Joe Biden didn't do well there. He was in fourth place, and Elizabeth Warren was in third place. And then you go to New Hampshire, and Bernie Sanders wins, but by less than 1% of the vote. Pete Buttigieg is second. Surprisingly, Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, in third with 20%. And then Jim, Elizabeth Warren, 9% in fourth place, and Joe Biden, 8% in fifth place. Then you've got Michael Bloomberg willing to spend, I don't know, $2 billion, $3 billion, $4 billion. How do you handicap the Democrat field where we stand today, Saturday, February 14th?
Well, here's what, Michael, I think. We've got a Democrat team of people that are running that are far, far too far left. And most of the people in these battleground states, you know, they want to have a good job. They don't want socialism. And, you know, when you have Bernie Sanders, you know, claiming that he is a socialist and he wants to get our country more toward that, you know, a socialist country, I think the battleground states and many of the states that I travel around, they're looking at these candidates and saying, I'm not, no matter what, even if I don't like President Trump, I am not going to vote for them. So the question is going to be, as in every election, turnout and who gets the most voters out to turn out. The fear I have with somebody like Bernie Sanders is look at the people in the audience. They're 21 to 30 years old. They do like socialism, but I don't think in the end the American popular vote or even Americans are going to vote, you know, for a socialist candidate. Which is why I continue to say, you know, you're going to see Bloomberg start to move up. Biden, I think, is pretty well gone, and Klobuchar brings us a little closer to the center. I think Mayor Pete, because most people don't know how to pronounce his last name. Brings people a little bit closer to the center. But in the end, I don't think any of the candidates today, other than Bloomberg, really do give Donald Trump a challenge. But that's why I think you're going to start to see Bloomberg start to move up.
I think you're right about that. And it comes down to he's worth like $50 billion. He's 77, 78 years old. He hates Donald Trump. He totally hates his guts. And he wants to beat him. And so my guess is he'll end up spending, he said he'll spend $1 billion. I think he'll spend up to $5 billion. And, you know, in politics, well, as you know, money matters. Money matters a lot.
Absolutely. And you know what I've said all along? I always talk about Ohio. Ohio's not a red state. It's not a blue state. It's a green state. It's a, and I think that, I think politics is like that. It's, if you have the money, you can put any position out there. When I ran against, the senator in 2018, he spent $33.5 million telling people, stories about me. And the other thing that always frustrated me, Michael, about politics is you can say anything you want, even if it's untrue. So, you're going to see a lot of that occurring, and Bloomberg will have the money to be able to put up a defense. And I think, you know, again, it's going to come down to these states where we keep talking about, these battleground states, and who can win them and who can win the heart and soul of that middle-class voter, that Democrat, that Reagan Democrat who really just wants a future for their family and their children and their grandchildren. And, boy, if that message can be – can be put out there by Bloomberg, because that's the message that Donald Trump is now getting people to follow, then it's going to be a tighter race.
So former New York City mayor, billionaire, 50 billionaire, Mike Bloomberg was in Nashville this past week. And from our sister publication, the Tennessee Star, Chris Butler reported on it. And basically, he just got up and delivered a bunch of left-wing talking points that included raising estate taxes and crushing the National Rifle Association, essentially limiting Second Amendment rights. I don't think, Jim, my view is, I don't think that plays very well in battleground states. What do you think on those particular issues?
Well, I would agree with you, but remember, in a primary, you got to win the primary, and in a general election, I bet you, I would agree 100%, but I bet you Bloomberg will start moving to the center, because right now, he's up against left-wing socialists, and he's got to win the primary. So he's going to talk about things that he believes in. Now, I do know that he does believe in taking away Second Amendment rights, and I know that he is a big climate change person. And those things he probably won't change, but I do think he'll try and soften that message, because he has to win the general election.
And, you know, when I look at Michael Bloomberg, I'm reminded of that famous saying by Richard Nixon, who said, as a candidate for president, in the primaries, you run as far to the right as you can, and in the general, you run as far to the center as you can. And that's probably Michael Bloomberg's approach here as he's trying to buy his way to the, or as Steve Bannon says, do a leverage buyout of the Democratic Party. We'll be back with the Battleground State Report and our guest host today, Jim Renacci. After this, I'm Michael Patrick Leahy. And welcome back to the Battleground State Report. I'm Michael Patrick Leahy, sitting in for Doug Kellett today, former Congressman Jim Renacci. Jim, you wrote a book about your time serving in Congress, four terms in Congress. The book is called The GOP's Lost Decade, An Inside View of Why Washington Doesn't Work. What are the key themes of that book that you learned as a congressman for 8 years?
Michael, one of the things when I wrote the book, I really didn't want, I wanted people to get a sense of what Jim Renacci learned in his 8 years in Washington. And it was a very frustrating place for a business guy and for many people that go there that have this thought process that we can get things done. You find out very quickly that the swamp and the system really dictates what happens. And I talked about that. I talked about how, Boehner went there with a plan as speaker, but clearly it was about power, keeping power. And then when he decided to leave, he anointed Paul Ryan, and all Paul Ryan worried about was maintaining the power, because it's not about the people in Washington, it's about the power, and I write about that. I write about the theory that if you're there for more than 8 years and you love being there, you're part of the problem, because nobody should like going someplace where you can't get anything done. But at the end, I talk about the solutions too. I mean, we were so worried when we were in the majority that we were going to lose the majority that we never did anything. I mean, other than the tax bill and jobs cut bill, which got passed during our tenure in the majority, that was really pushed by the president because so often the leadership just did not want to do anything that would cause them to lose a majority. I was so frustrated in my years in Washington where, you know, whether it was Boehner or Paul Ryan saying, hey, we can't do that because we're going to lose the majority, or we can't do that because we're going to lose the majority. We lost it anyway. So I talked about that. I talked about some little inside stories. I talked about working on a bipartisan basis. That doesn't mean that you have to give up your principles or values, but you know, there are some Democrats who actually are worried about their children and grandchildren, too, and they're worried about fiscal conservatism, so we need to talk about that. And I talked about a fiscal state of the nation address, which I pushed for 8 years. And then at the end, Michael, I talk about solutions. And there are solutions. One of them is we do need term limits because and I know there are people that disagree. I talk to conservatives that say, no, I don't. The electorate should decide whether somebody should be termed out. The problem is the electorate doesn't decide because the money and the power become so strong that you can't overtake some of these guys. And the process, here's probably the biggest issue. People don't realize there is a process. The forefathers put a process in place. Nobody follows it down there. We don't do budgets. We don't vote on budgets. We don't do appropriations bills. We don't do all the basic things that our founders wanted us to do. And if we just go back to the process and start to term limit people out so they don't have the power and the money, the process will overtake and we'll be able to get a lot of things done.
So here's a question I've always wanted to ask a member of Congress and never got around to it. How did it happen that the budget process stopped working? Because I recall, you know, growing up as a kid, there was something called regular order, right? Which is how you reviewed a budget. A budget would be broken down into a various subcommittees on particular areas, and they would review a proposed budget in the areas that they had expertise. It would go up to a committee, go on all the way through the process, and when all the committees had vetted it and thought, well, this is a good idea, then it would be put in an entire budget process in a timely manner before the end of the fiscal year, and there would be an up or down vote on it. What on earth? When did that go away?
Well, it's interesting because what I found is, and it's a great question, and most people don't realize, the Budget Act was passed in 1974. So I kept saying, when did it go away? How did this happen? Well, some people say, well, the budget was working in the late 90s when Clinton and Kasich balanced the budget. It wasn't working then either. Even though in those 6 years we balanced the budget, if you really go back and look, you'll see that they balanced for $2 trillion worth of spending over 6 years and $2 trillion worth of revenue, and they spent like $5 trillion during those 6 years. The only thing that helped us in that time period was we had a boom in the economy. We had 6.2, 6.3. Those were the growth in those years. And for your listeners, that was the tech boom. That was the time that we had unmatched growth in our country. So we were able to make it look like the budget was working, but it really wasn't because we spent more than we budgeted, and thank goodness our revenues came in much higher than we spent, and that's how we ended up balancing the budget. So even the budget wasn't working back then. And if you go all the way back into the 70s, there was always a mechanism to bypass the budget, and it's been used. I mean, you know, in the business world, if you bypass the budget, but in the congressional world, there are ways to, not follow the budget. I had a bill, Michael, at one point in time that I said every member of Congress that breaks the budget should have to go down on the House floor and spend 7 minutes as to why he's breaking the budget, even though we weren't passing a budget. And you know what? I couldn't get any support for that either. That's what you'd have to do in the real world, but we haven't seen it all the way back to 1974. There are always ways to bypass the process, and you hit the nail on the head. If we had regular order and we had the process working, budgets would have to be passed. We couldn't spend what we're spending, and we'd be able to fix things.
So here's what's interesting to me. At some point, so you get there, at what point in your first term, and you're sworn in January of 2011, I guess, at what point did the idea come to your mind that, well, these guys are just doing this budget all wrong? How long did it take you to figure that out? And then after you figured it out, who did you talk to about it, and how did they respond?
Well, it's interesting. When I first got there, the chairman of the budget committee was Paul Ryan, and I was on the budget committee. That was the first place that I was assigned to. And, I mean, it was a great place to be because you learned how spending worked. You learned that we were on a trajectory. Here's a lot of your listeners probably aren't aware. 70% of what the federal government spend is on autopilot. It is, by law, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and interest. You can't change it unless you change the law. So it just grows and grows and grows. So what we're really budgeting is and then we have 70% is Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, interest. 15% is defense, and 15% is everything else. So most of the time, we're talking about the 15% that's everything else, but we're spending almost 30% more than we're bringing in, and nobody is really looking at the drivers of the debt, which is Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, interest. So I started to realize unless we fix that, we can't fix anything. And if you're a politician wanting to be reelected, one of the things that you have to avoid talking about is Medicare, Medicaid. So now I did. But if you talk about Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, you're automatically not going to be reelected. So it's just forgotten about. And that's where the budget process is really broken. We have to start looking at mandatory spending and making adjustments for it.
So set the scene here for me. So you're there and you're on the budget committee, and the chairman is Paul Ryan. Smart guy, but not exactly what I would call a conservative. So do you have a conversation with him and say, hey, when are we going to address these things, and how does he respond to you?
So one of the things I did, Michael, when I was there is I never really went to, you know, there are a lot of people, there are show horses and work horses, they call them in Congress. The show horses are the ones that are on TV every night. I mean, every time you turn on your TV, and it happens even tonight, you turn on the TV, you'll see the show horses, and then the work horses you never hear from. Well, the work horses were people like myself that would go to Paul Ryan and others and say, look, we can't do this. We got to change that. We can't make this, you know, this just isn't going to work. And they would look at me. I mean, my best example was I had something called the Fiscal State of the Nation Address. I said that I wanted the Comptroller General to come before Congress once a year and give us a fiscal state of the nation. You know, the president comes and he gives us a glossy state of the nation. I want a fiscal state of the nation. I want it in front of the Senate. I want it in front of the House, and I want it on national TV. And they would look at me and go, oh, the economy will tumble. If you tell the American people that their fiscal state is in jeopardy, you'll have the bond markets tumbling. I even had one senior member of Congress saying, Moody's will downgrade us. I went up to New York City, met with Moody's, the president of Moody's, and he kind of chuckled and said, we already know the fiscal state of the country. And because you are such, because the United States is such in such better shape than other countries, we're not going to drop your credit rating until such time as the other countries become better than you, which is probably a little further down the road. But we have to be cautious of that. But it shows you how leadership really didn't want the facts to come out, so it wouldn't happen. And even though I got over 200 co-sponsors for that fiscal state of the nation address, leadership stopped it from getting on the floor. That's how they do things. They make sure you only need 217 votes to pass something. Even if you had 217 votes, leadership can say that bill's never going to get to the floor, and that's how they stop the process from working.
So I'm guessing that former Speaker of the House Paul Ryan doesn't send you Christmas cards.
Well, you know what? I've always been friends with Paul Ryan. I don't really say anything negative. In the book, here's what I talk about Paul. I said Paul was a good guy to be in the background. He didn't want the job as Speaker. I was with him the day that he was being pushed into the Speaker on a Friday. I was with him at the airport. I remember him telling me, I really don't want the job. And I said, then don't take it. The problem is once you get that job, you realize how much power you have, and then you don't want to give it up. And that's the problem. Being Speaker of the House is a pretty powerful position. You raise 30, 40, 50. I mean, a lot of people don't realize. Paul raised in his last 6 months, even though he was kind of a lame duck speaker. We weren't doing anything while we were waiting to see whether the Democrats took over. He raised $11, $12 million. He transferred into a 501c3, I believe. Because that's another thing the American people don't realize. You can raise all that money, transfer it into a non-for-profit, and then become the executive director of that non-for-profit and live out the rest of your life as the executive director of a not-for-profit.
Well, it sounds like a nice job if you can get it. But I guess he saw the writing on the wall and decided to leave the speakership. Do you see Paul Ryan getting back into politics ever?
You know what? I do think that Paul, he was not a pro-Trumper. There were times that he gave that message to our caucus that this guy is dangerous. Now he tried to work with him, but in the end, I do think Paul Ryan wants to be president someday. He moved back to Washington, by the way. He took that money, started that non-for-profit. He's back in Washington D.C. with his family. So
I would expect to see Paul Ryan rise again at some point.
That's very interesting. I didn't know that. So, well, Jim Renacci, former Congressman Jim Renacci, thanks so much for joining us today here on the Battleground State Report. Will you come back and guest host another segment in the future?
Absolutely. I look forward to it, and I look forward to talking about the Battleground States.
All right, Jim Renacci, former Congressman. Thanks, and we'll be back next week here with the Battleground State Report. I'm Michael Patrick Leahy. Have a great week.